That's a fascinating insight. If I can just take a moment here in our quick concluding lecture to illustrate that. If you go to a wedding, if you're in a wedding party, you know, and the photographer gets you all together afterwards and is trying to get pictures, and the photographer says, stand over there, and he points. Is he being precise? No, he's not at all. Now, would it be accurate to say what he means is stand exactly right there? In fact, you could take the chalk and, you know, draw around the feet. Is that what he meant? Stand exactly right there? No, it isn't what he meant. He just meant over in that area. You stand on that step, you stand on that step, and, you know, generally that's okay. Now, that's a vague statement. However, as a vague statement, it accomplishes exactly what the photographer wants. He doesn't mean something more precise or less precise than that. That ordinary usage, though it may be called vague from one perspective, is perfectly acceptable and meaningful for what it is. And so Wittgenstein said, we don't need to reduce all vague language to the precision of science. Nor do we need to reduce all language in general for its cognitive meaningfulness to the language of science. And not everything that's complex that we refer to in our language is properly translated into simple things that are grouped together. And Wittgenstein had another insight that's worth mentioning, and that's that things can belong to the same category, can be part of a generalization, even though there's no single feature that is held in common to all the things. A few days ago, I referred to the family resemblance notion. There are things, everything that's in a family belongs there because of some kind of resemblance, but the resemblance is not the same in every member of the family. There are overlapping similarities, and there are different kinds of similarity. And so Wittgenstein wants to get away from the artificiality of reducing all generalizations to some common property, all complexities to simple components, all vague statements to precise statements, and all the uses of language to scientific use. Basically, what Wittgenstein is saying here is, the world is a lot richer and a lot fuller than this artificial language of logical analysis, either logical atomism or logical positivism, would ever lead you to believe. Now, why do we have philosophical problems then, according to Wittgenstein? Well, philosophical problems arise because we've gotten away from ordinary usage. That is, when we look at the way words are used in their ordinary setting, people don't have any problem with them. I gave you the example of time the other day. You don't have any difficulty when I say, what time is it? So time, as it's used in ordinary settings, is not a difficult notion. But take it out of its ordinary usage, abstract it into a problem of philosophy, what is time? And then we all get messed up. Don't know what to say about it. What is the essence of time? You know? And so the problems of philosophy, according to Wittgenstein, are problems that come about because we've messed up our use of language. So we do need to do linguistic analysis, but not to produce an ideal language of science, but to get back to ordinary usage and away from contrived artificial uses of words that create problems for the philosopher. According to Wittgenstein, philosophical problems are not solved, they're dissolved. They're not solved. It's not like, oh, you got this big problem, you know, in Hegel. How does the thesis and the antithesis come to synthesis and so forth? Wittgenstein would say, we don't need to solve that problem. We don't even need to solve the problem of, is everything we know is based on empirical experience or upon rational conceptions and so forth. We can get away from that. We don't solve those problems. We dissolve those problems. We dissolve them by looking at the use of language and returning it to its ordinary use. The difficulty in philosophy, as he put it in one of his most famous aphorisms, is that language has gone on holiday, the English expression for vacation. Language is up and gone on holiday. It's as though the car is running, we're using the words, but it's not in gear. We're not using it in the ordinary way. And when it goes on vacation like that, when it goes on holiday, then it creates all these problems. And all we need to do is dissolve them. Or, again, to use the illustration of the fly being let out of the fly bottle. Yes, philosophy should be performed. And yes, it's tied to linguistic analysis, but it's for the sake of therapy. The therapy of returning our language to ordinary usage away from the contrived artificial usage of the philosophers. And so we use philosophy not to answer the big questions, but simply to cure our misconceptions about the world. A number of philosophers whose names only I'll be able to mention for you today have acquired quite a reputation in the tradition then of what's called ordinary language analysis. That is, they've taken this approach and now started to apply it to various difficulties in philosophy. And so you should know the name of Gilbert Ryle, R-Y-L-E, the name of John Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N, and John Searle, S-E-A-R-L, Strawson, S-T-R-A-W-S-O-N. Well, there might be others, but if you remember Ryle and Strawson and Austin and Searle in particular, these are men who are contemporary philosophers now. I mean, that brought you right up into our generation of scholarship, who have developed ordinary language analysis and applied it to various things. Now, do I have any problem with the later Wittgenstein? After all, I've told you that I was trained in ordinary language analysis and that's my methodology in philosophy. Does that mean that I think that this has answered all the problems? Absolutely not. I only have time to mention two outstanding difficulties, however. Well, no, maybe I'll take time for it. The first one is this. From the standpoint of my religious convictions, it may seem that the later Wittgenstein in ordinary language analysis provides us with a wonderful place to stand in the world, because now we don't have the scientists beating up on us saying, oh, what you're saying is nonsense. It can't be reduced to the ideal language of logic and science, and so it has to be ruled out. What Wittgenstein has done is he's opened the door and say, look, linguistic communities use expressions in various ways, and there's a linguistic community, let's say Reformed theology or Christian theology in general, and there is a social use and application of this kind of language, the language of prayer, the language of preaching, the language of exhortation, the language of ethics, whatever it may be, the language of religious devotion is just one of many language games. Here, game doesn't mean trivial, it just means there's a loose association of rules and applications, procedures that are followed. And so that might appear to be a concession that we would like to latch on to as Christians and say, our language game is different than the language game of the atheist, the materialist, or what have you. And that is true. That is descriptively true. The atheist will not reform his language to glorify God and to speak in such a way that God is brought into the picture and that we bow before him and we praise his name and we recite his commandments and declare his goodness and believe his promises. That's true. But it's a descriptive truth and it doesn't get down to the question of whether what we are saying is universally true or not. The difficulty with ordinary language analysis is that it tends to degenerate into social subjectivism. Social subjectivism. A few lectures ago, I talked about phenomenology being an attempt to get away from the Kantian skepticism. And phenomenology, though it's not a successful effort, has its degenerate form in existentialism. Existentialism wants to look at the phenomena of man and draw conclusions from it. And existentialism degenerates into private subjectivism, individual subjectivism, where everybody creates his own values and so forth. Well, ordinary language analysis is not a radical subjectivism of that sort. It's rather a social subjectivism, where you have different speaking communities wherein statements make sense and have a use and so forth. But then which community is right or wrong when it comes to how we speak about God or how we speak about material objects or how we speak about ethics? To that, the ordinary language analyst can't give an answer because in ordinary language analysis, this is the bottom line, you're doing description, not prescription. You're not prescribing what is true, saying this is what universally people should say and how they should use their language. Instead, you're just describing the way people use their language and then helping them to get, you know, out of the conceptual traps that have been developed because they've contrived the use of words. They've become artificial, as the philosophers do. Language went on holiday. So my first difficulty with ordinary language analysis is that it reduces to social subjectivism if you don't have something more to say as a philosopher than that. And of course, I have more to say. But as a tool of philosophy, I'm pretty enthusiastic for it. I think it's real helpful to pay attention to the way language is used, and particularly not to become artificial there and try to reduce everything to some narrow use of language, like the language of the physicist and so forth. The second problem that I have with ordinary language analysis is somewhat akin to the first, but I think it's making a distinctive point, and that is that ordinary language analysis doesn't enable us to have objective, public answers for the traditional problems of philosophy. What I said to you a few minutes ago is that it's therapy. It has, if you will, just a negative function. It helps us to clean up the artificialities of our scholarly, philosophical use of language. It helps us to get back to ordinary usage. It lets the fly out of the bottle. Well, if that's all true, well and good. But philosophy is more than that, because philosophy also requires us to come up with a comprehensive view of our experience. What is man? What is the world in which he lives? What is man's place in the world? How should he live his life? Linguistic analysis turns out to be a mitigated philosophy. Sound familiar? It's in that train of 20th century thought that turns away from doing philosophy in the grand manner where we can have a systematic, comprehensive worldview such that we know the nature of reality, how we know what we know, and how we should live our lives in terms of it. And I cannot be satisfied with linguistic analysis if it shunts us off into the backwaters of just doing the therapy, cleaning up our language, and giving up, as I said, philosophy in the grand manner. Now, of course, you know what a linguistic analyst would say to me. He'd say, who needs to do philosophy in the grand manner? He would have a pragmatic answer. He'd say, we're getting by fine without having these philosophical answers. Well, what did I say when I lectured to you on pragmatism? Well, you don't know if you're getting by fine, do you? When you say we're getting by fine, we can just use the language, you know, of these particular social groups or different divisions of the university that we're in. You don't know that there isn't something beyond that that you need to take account of. We do need to get back to the question of what is truth, how do we know it, what is the nature of reality, who is man, how should he live his life. The linguistic analysts notice, because they won't do philosophy in the grand manner, they can't help men, can they, except clean up their conceptual apparatus a bit. When I say they can't help men, linguistic analysts are really paralyzed in the face of the difficulties of social philosophy. John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx. Now, I don't agree with either one of these men, but they realized we've got problems. We need to apply our intellect, our reason, to social reform. Well, linguistic analysts, they don't engage in social reform. And why should they? Or if they do, it's kind of like a pasted-on part of their life. It doesn't grow out of their philosophy, because their philosophy can't help us reform society. Why? Because their philosophy doesn't tell us what is right and wrong. It just tells us how we use our language about right and wrong. So analysts cannot help us solve our human problems. Who am I? Am I made in the image of God? Will I answer to God one day? How should I live my life? How should society be reformed? And so linguistic analysis is too narrow. It's real broad when it comes to its understanding of language, but it's too narrow as to what philosophers need to get accomplished. And then thirdly, let me add real quickly, if the goal of analysis is finally to gain clarity, remember there are two ways of doing that. The atomist and the positivist gain clarity by developing an ideal language. And if anything fit into it, then it was clear. Linguistic analysis that goes the route of ordinary language analysis wants to gain clarity too, but it's not of the sort of that precision, stand exactly there, or the precision of physics. But nevertheless, it's clarity as how this language is used in this social community.